All the others who saw him doing this were fully persuaded that he was fully resolved to remain and fight the war through. But Mardonius was not at all deceived by any of this, since he was most experienced in the king's way of thinking. While Xerxes was doing these things, he also sent a messenger to Persia to announce the disaster that had befallen them. Of these messengers, there is nothing among mortal things that arrives faster. This is how it has been devised by the Persians. For they say that for as many days as the whole journey takes, that many horses and men are stationed at intervals, one for each day's journey, each with a horse assigned to him. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor night keeps them from completing their appointed course with all speed. The first rider hands off his instructions to the next, who in turn passes them along to the one after him, and from there, the message runs on through one man after another, just as in the torch race that the Greeks perform for Hephaestus. The Persians call this relay of horses the Angarian. Now the first message that arrived at Susa, that Xerxes held Athens, delighted those Persians left behind so much that they strewed all the roads with myrtle and burned incense, and were themselves engaged in sacrifices and festivities. But the second message that came upon them threw them into such confusion that they all tore their tunics and gave themselves over to endless shouting and wailing, laying the blame on Mardonius. It was not so much grief over the ships that made the Persians act this way as fear for Xerxes himself. And this went on among the Persians the whole time in between, until Xerxes himself arrived and put a stop to it. Mardonius, seeing that Xerxes took the sea battle very hard, and suspecting that he was planning flight from Athens, reflected to himself that he would pay the penalty for having persuaded the king to march against Greece, and that facing the risk of conquering Greece, or else dying honorably himself, having been raised up for great things, was preferable. Yet his judgment leaned more toward subduing Greece. So having reckoned this, he brought forward the following proposal. "Master, do not grieve, and do not take this event that has happened as any great disaster, for it is not wood that decides everything for us, but men and horses. None of these men who now think they have accomplished everything will disembark from their ships to try to oppose you, nor will anyone come out from this mainland to do so. Those who did oppose us have paid the penalty. Now if it seems good, let us attempt the Peloponnese at once, and if it seems good to wait, that too can be arranged. Do not be discouraged, for there is no escape for the Greeks from having to answer, sooner or later, for what they have done, both now and before, and become your slaves. So above all, do this. But if you have in fact decided to withdraw and lead the army away yourself, I have another plan besides. Do not, O king, let the Persians become an object of ridicule to the Greeks, for in the Persians' case nothing has been damaged in this affair, nor can you say where we proved cowardly. If the Phoenicians and Egyptians and Cypriots and Cilicians proved cowardly, that disaster has nothing to do with the Persians. Since then it is not the Persians who are at fault, listen to me. If you have resolved not to remain, march back to your own land, taking the greater part of the army with you, but I must furnish you with Greece enslaved, choosing out 300,000 of the army for myself. When Xerxes heard this, he rejoiced, as one does out of troubles, and was pleased, and after deliberating with Mardonius, he said he would decide which of the two courses he would take. As he was deliberating with the invited Persians, it occurred to him to summon Artemisia to the council as well, since earlier she alone had seemed to know what should be done. When Artemisia arrived, having dismissed the others, both the Persian counselors and the bodyguards, Xerxes said this: "Mardonius urges me to remain here and attempt the Peloponnese, telling me that the Persian forces and the infantry bear no blame at all for what happened, but would be glad to give proof of it. He therefore urges me either to do this, or else he himself wishes to choose out 300,000 of the army and furnish me with Greece enslaved, while he urges me to march off along with what remains of the army toward my own homeland. You then advise me, for you also advised me well about the sea battle that took place, urging me not to bring it about, now too advise me which course I should take to succeed by good counsel." So he asked her advice, and she said this: "King, it is difficult for one giving advice to hit upon the best course when asked, but given the present circumstances, it seems to me that you yourself should march back, while Mardonius, if he wishes and undertakes to do as he says, should be left behind with those he wishes. For if he subdues what he claims he wishes, and things go for him as he plans, the achievement, master, becomes yours, since your slaves accomplished it. But if the opposite of Mardonius's design comes about, it will be no great disaster as long as you yourself survive, and those affairs concerning your own house survive too. For as long as you yourself survive and your house survives, the Greeks will have to run many races, many times, for their own survival. But if something happens to Mardonius, it is of no account, nor will the Greeks in winning have won anything, having destroyed only your slave, while you, having achieved the purpose for which you made this expedition, by burning Athens, will march away. Xerxes was delighted with this advice, for she happened to say exactly what he himself was thinking. Indeed, I think that even if all men and women together had advised him to remain, he would not have remained, so thoroughly had he been frightened. Having praised Artemisia, he sent her off to convey his children to Ephesus, for some illegitimate children of his were accompanying him. And with the children he sent as guardian Hermotimus, a Pedasian by birth, ranked not second among the eunuchs in the king's favor. The Pedasians live above Halicarnassus, and among these Pedasians the following thing is said to occur. Whenever something difficult is going to happen within a set time to all the people dwelling around the city, then the priestess of Athena there grows a great beard. This has already happened to them twice. It was from among these Pedasians that Hermotimus came, the man who, of all we know, exacted the greatest vengeance for a wrong done to him. He had been captured by enemies and put up for sale, and was bought by a man of Chios named Panaenius, who made his living from the most unholy of trades. Whenever he acquired boys of outstanding looks, he would castrate them and take them to sell at Sardis and Ephesus for large sums, since among the barbarians eunuchs are valued more highly than others, for the sake of their complete trustworthiness. Panaenius castrated many others besides, making his living from this practice, and this man among them. And since Hermotimus did not suffer misfortune in everything, he came from Sardis to the king bearing gifts along with the rest, and as the years passed, he was honored above all the eunuchs by Xerxes. When the Persian army was setting out against Athens while the king was at Sardis, Hermotimus, having gone down for some reason into the land, the Chians occupy, known by the name Atarneus, found Panaenius there. Recognizing him, he greeted him warmly and spoke many friendly words, telling him first of all the good things he himself owed to him, and second promising him in return all the good things that would follow if he brought his household and came to live there, so that Panaenius, gladly welcoming these words, brought his children and his wife. And when he had got his whole household in his power, Hermotimus said this: O man who of all men has gained his living from the most unholy deeds, what evil did I, or any of my ancestors, ever do to you or to any of yours, that you made me, instead of a man, into nothing? Did you think the gods would fail to notice what you were contriving then? They, following the just law, have brought you, for the unholy deeds you did, into my hands, so that you cannot complain of the justice that is now going to be done to you by me. Having reproached him with this, when his children were brought before his eyes, Panaenius was forced to cut off the genitals of his own four sons, and being forced, he did it. And when he had done this, his sons, being forced in turn, cut his off. So it was that vengeance and Hermotimus came round upon Panaenius in this way. Xerxes, after entrusting his children to Artemisia to take away to Ephesus, called Mardonius and ordered him to choose out from the army whatever men he wished, and to try to make his deeds match his words. For that day, matters went thus far, and during the night, on the king's order, the generals led the ships back from Phalerum to the Hellespont as quickly as each could manage, so as to guard the bridges for the king's crossing. When the barbarians, sailing near Zoster, saw thin headlands jutting out from this mainland, they thought they were ships and fled for a long distance. But in time, learning that they were not ships but headlands, they gathered together and continued on their way. When day came, the Greeks, seeing the land army remaining in place, expected the ships to be near Phalerum as well, and thought they would fight a sea battle and made ready to defend themselves. But when they learned that the ships had gone, immediately after this they decided to pursue. Now they did not catch sight of Xerxes' naval force in their pursuit as far as Andros, and having arrived at Andros they took counsel. Themistocles then put forward the view that they should turn among the islands, and having pursued the ships, sail straight for the Hellespont to break the bridges. But Eurybiades proposed the opposite view, saying that if they broke the bridges, this above all things would do Greece the greatest harm. For if the Persian were forced to remain in Europe, he would try not to stay quiet, since if he stayed quiet, no progress in his affairs would be possible for him, nor would any way home appear, and his army would perish of famine. But if he made the attempt and set his hand to the work next, everything in Europe would fall to them, city by city and people by people, whether by conquest or by prior surrender, and they would have as food forever the annual produce of the Greeks. But since he thought the Persian, defeated in the sea battle, would not remain in Europe, he said they should let him flee, until in his flight he came to his own country. From that point on, he urged, the struggle should be waged over his territory. The other Peloponnesian generals held to this same opinion. But when Themistocles realized he would not persuade the majority to sail to the Hellespont, he turned to the Athenians instead, for they, being most vexed at the enemy's escape, were eager to sail to the Hellespont and to attempt it even on their own if the others were unwilling. And he said the following to them, I myself have been present at many such events and have heard of many more like them. Men driven to necessity, once defeated, fighting back and recovering from their former misfortune. But as for us, since we have found a windfall for ourselves and for Greece, having driven back so vast a swarm of men, we should not chase after men who are fleeing. For it is not we who accomplished this, but the gods and heroes, who begrudge that one man should be king of both Asia and Europe, a man both unholy and reckless, who made no distinction between sacred things and private, burning and toppling the statues of the gods, who even scourged the sea and cast fetters into it. But since things stand well for us as they are now, let us for the present remain in Greece. Each of us should tend to himself and to his household, rebuild his house, and see carefully to the sowing of his fields, once he has driven the barbarian completely away. And with the coming of spring, let us sail down to the Hellespont and Ionia. He said this intending to lay up credit with the Persian, so that if any misfortune should befall him at the hands of the Athenians, he would have a way of escape. And indeed that is exactly what happened. By saying these things Themistocles was practicing deception, but the Athenians believed him. For since he had already before this been reputed wise and had shown himself to be truly wise and prudent in counsel, they were altogether ready to trust what he said. When they had been won over by him, immediately after this Themistocles sent men in a boat, men whom he trusted to keep silent even under every kind of torture, to tell the king what he himself had instructed them to say. Among them was Sisinnus, his household servant once again. When they arrived off the coast of Attica, the others remained with the boat while Sisinnus went up to Xerxes and said the following, Themistocles, son of Neocles, general of the Athenians and the best and wisest man of all the allies, has sent me to tell you that Themistocles the Athenian, wishing to do you a service, held back the Greeks when they wanted to pursue your ships and to break up the bridges in the Hellespont. Now you may withdraw at your leisure. Having delivered this message, they sailed back. The Greeks, since they had decided against chasing the barbarians' ships any farther, and against sailing toward the Hellespont to destroy the crossing there, laid siege around Andros, wishing to seize it. Among the islanders, the Andrians were first asked by Themistocles for money, and refused it. And when Themistocles put forward this argument, that the Athenians had come with two great gods on their side, persuasion and necessity, and that therefore they were certainly obliged to give money, they answered in reply, saying that it was quite reasonable that Athens should be great and prosperous, since she was blessed with useful gods, but that the Andrians themselves were exceedingly short of land, and that two useless gods never left their island but always clung fondly to it, poverty and helplessness, and that the Andrians, being in the grip of these gods, would give no money, for never could the power of Athens be stronger than their own powerlessness. Having answered in this way and having refused to give the money, they were besieged. Themistocles, for he did not stop pursuing his own advantage, sent threatening messages to the other islands as well, demanding money through the same messengers he had used with the king, saying that if they did not give what was asked, he would bring up the army of the Greeks and destroy them by siege. By saying this, he gathered great sums from the people of Carystus and Paros, who, on learning that Andros was under siege because it had Medized, and that Themistocles was held in the highest esteem among the generals, sent money out of fear. Whether any other islanders also gave, I cannot say, though I think that some others did give as well, and not only these. Yet the Carystians suffered no lesser misfortune on this account. The Parians, however, by appeasing Themistocles with money, escaped the army altogether. Themistocles, then, operating from Andros, acquired money from the islanders in secret from the other generals. Meanwhile, Xerxes and his men, after waiting a few days following the sea battle, marched off toward Boeotia by the same road. For Mardonius had decided that he would see the king off partway, and since it was now too late in the season for warfare, that it was better to winter in Thessaly, and then, with the coming of spring, to make an attempt on the Peloponnese. When they arrived in Thessaly, Mardonius there picked out first of all the Persians, all those called the Immortals, except for Hydarnes their commander, for he said he would not leave the king's side. And after them, from the rest of the Persians, the breastplate wearers and the 1,000 horsemen, and the Medes and Sacchi and Bactrians and Indians, both infantry and the rest of the cavalry. These whole peoples he took entire, but from the other allies he picked out only a few at a time, choosing men of fine appearance or those he knew had done something useful. But the one people he chose in the greatest number was the Persians, men who wore torques and bracelets, and after them the Medes. These were not fewer in number than the Persians, but inferior in strength. So that altogether they numbered 300,000, cavalry included. During this time, while Mardonius was selecting his army and Xerxes was still around Thessaly, an oracle had come from Delphi to the Lacedaemonians, telling them to demand satisfaction from Xerxes for the killing of Leonidas and to accept whatever he offered. So the Spartans sent a herald with all speed, who, when he caught up with the army, still entirely in Thessaly, came before Xerxes and addressed him thus: "King of the Medes, the Lacedaemonians and the descendants of Heracles from Sparta demand from you satisfaction for a killing, because you killed their king while he was defending Greece." Xerxes laughed and, after a long pause, since Mardonius happened to be standing beside him, pointed to him and said, "Well then, Mardonius here will give them the satisfaction that is fitting for them." The herald, taking this answer, departed. Xerxes, leaving Mardonius behind in Thessaly, himself marched in haste to the Hellespont and reached the crossing point in 45 days, bringing back scarcely any part of his army, so to speak. Wherever they went on their march and among whatever peoples they passed, they seized and ate the crops of those people. But if they found no crops at all, they gathered the grass growing up from the ground and stripped the bark from trees and picked their leaves and ate them, whether from cultivated or wild trees alike, and left nothing behind. This they did out of hunger. Plague and dysentery also seized the army along the road and destroyed it. Those among them who fell sick, he left behind, ordering the cities where he happened to be marching at the time to care for and feed them, some in Thessaly, some in Ceres in Paeonia, and some in Macedonia. It was there that he had left the sacred chariot of Zeus when he marched against Greece, and on his way back he did not recover it, for the Paeonians had handed it over to the Thracians, and later, when Xerxes demanded it back, claimed that it had been seized while grazing by the Thracians living further up near the sources of the Strymon. There too the king of the Byzantine and of the Crestonian land, a Thracian, did a monstrous thing. He himself said he would never willingly be enslaved to Xerxes, and went off up into Mount Rhodope, and forbade his sons to campaign against Greece. But they, paying no heed, or perhaps simply feeling a desire to watch the war, campaigned along with the Persian, and when all 6 of them returned unharmed, their father gouged out their eyes for this reason. This was the reward they received. As for the Persians, marching on from Thrace, they arrived at the crossing point and hastened to cross the Hellespont in their ships to Abydos, for they no longer found the bridges of boats stretched across, but broken apart by a storm. There, while held up, they got a larger ration of food than they had had on the march, and eating without any restraint and changing waters, many of the surviving army died. The rest, together with Xerxes, arrived at Sardis. There is also another story told, that when Xerxes marching away from Athens reached Ion on the Strymon, from there he no longer traveled by land, but put Hydarnes in charge of leading the army back to the Hellespont, and boarded a Phoenician ship himself to be carried to Asia. As he sailed, a great and stormy wind called the Strymonian is said to have caught him. And since the storm grew worse as the ship was overloaded, so that on the deck there were many Persians of those traveling with Xerxes, the king, falling into terror, called out to the helmsman and asked whether there was any way of safety for them. And the man said, "Master, there is none, unless some relief is made from these many passengers." And Xerxes, on hearing this, is said to have replied, "Men of Persia, now let one of you show his care for the king, for it is in your hands, seems to be my only safety." He said this, and they, doing obeisance, leapt into the sea, and the ship, thus lightened, made it safely across to Asia. As soon as Xerxes had disembarked on land, he did the following. Because the man had saved the king's life, he gave the helmsman a golden crown, but because he had destroyed many Persians, he cut off his head. This is another story told about Xerxes' homeward journey, but it seems to me in no way credible, neither in general nor in this particular, about the fate of the Persians. For if these words had really been spoken by the helmsman to Xerxes, I have not found one opinion in 10,000 that would disagree that the king would have done the following instead. Brought down onto the hold those on the deck, since they were Persians and indeed the foremost of the Persians, while the rowers were Phoenicians, so that he would have thrown into the sea an equal number of the Phoenicians. But in truth, as noted earlier, he returned to Asia by the land route, marching with the rest of his army. This too is strong evidence. It is clear that Xerxes, on his return journey, arrived at Abdera and made a pact of friendship with them and gave them gifts, a golden sword and a tiara worked with gold thread. And as the Abderites themselves say, though what they say seems to me in no way credible, he first loosened his belt in flight from Athens on his way back, once he felt himself safe. Now Abdera lies nearer to the Hellespont than to the Strymon and Ion, from which they say he boarded the ship. The Greeks, when they were unable to take Andros, turned instead to Carystus, and having ravaged its territory, departed for Salamis. First of all, then, they set aside first fruits for the gods, including 3 Phoenician triremes, one to be dedicated at the Isthmus, which was still there in my time, one at Sunium, and one to Ajax himself at Salamis. After this, they divided up the spoil and sent the first fruits to Delphi, from which a statue was made holding in its hand the ornament of a ship's prow, being 12 cubits in size. It stands where the golden statue of Alexander the Macedonian stands. Having sent the first fruits to Delphi, the Greeks asked the god, jointly, whether he had received the first fruits in full and to his satisfaction. He said that he had received them in full from the other Greeks, but not from the Aeginetans, and he demanded from them the prize for valor for the sea battle at Salamis. The Aeginetans, on learning this, dedicated golden stars, which stand on a bronze mast, 3 of them at the corner, very near the mixing bowl of Croesus. After the division of the spoil, the Greeks sailed to the Isthmus to award the prize for valor to the man judged most worthy among the Greeks throughout this war. When the generals arrived, they distributed the votes at the altar of Poseidon, judging the first and second out of all, and there each of them cast a vote for himself, each thinking himself to have been the best, but for second place, the majority converged in judging Themistocles. So the others each got 1 vote apiece, but Themistocles far outstripped the rest for second place. Because the Greeks were unwilling to decide the matter out of envy, but each sailed off to his own home without a verdict, nevertheless Themistocles was proclaimed and reputed to be by far the wisest man among the Greeks throughout the whole of Greece. But because, though victorious, he was not honored by those who had fought at Salamis, he went soon after this to Lacedaemon, wanting to be honored. And the Lacedaemonians received him well and honored him greatly. As prizes for valor, they gave to Eurybiades a crown of olive, and to Themistocles too, for his wisdom and skill, a crown of olive, and they gave him the finest chariot in Sparta as a gift. Having praised him much, 300 chosen Spartans, those who are called the knights, escorted him on his departure as far as the borders of Tegea. He alone of all men we know of the Spartans ever escorted. When he arrived from Lacedaemon at Athens, there Timodmus of Aphidne, one of the enemies of Themistocles, but otherwise not among the distinguished men, maddened by envy, reviled Themistocles, bringing up his journey to Lacedaemon, saying that he had received the honors from the Lacedaemonians on account of Athens, not on account of himself. And he, when Timodmus would not stop saying this, said, "It is like this. I would not have been honored so by the Spartans had I been a Belbanite, nor would you, my good man, had you been an Athenian. So much then for that. Artabazus, son of Pharnaces, a man of repute among the Persians even before, and become still more so after the events at Plataea, having 6 myriads of troops that Mardonius had picked out, was accompanying the king on his journey as far as the strait. But when the king was in Asia, and Artabazus on his way back was passing through Pallene, since Mardonius was wintering around Thessaly and Macedonia and was in no hurry for him to come to the rest of the army, he did not think it right, having come upon the Potidaeans in revolt, not to enslave them. For the Potidaeans, once the king had passed by and the Persian fleet had fled away from Salamis, had openly revolted from the barbarians, and so too had the others who held Pallene. Thereupon Artabazus laid siege to Potidaea. Suspecting also that the Olynthians were revolting from the king, he laid siege to that city as well. It was held by the Bocchaeans, who had been driven out from the Thermaic Gulf by the Macedonians. When he had taken it by siege, he led the people out to a lake and slaughtered them, and handed over the city to Critobulus of Tauron and to the Chalcidian people to govern, and thus the Chalcidians got possession of Olynthus. Having destroyed the city, Artabazus applied himself intently to Potidaea. And as he pressed on eagerly, Timoxenus, the general of the Cyanaeans, agreed with him on a betrayal. In what manner it began at first I am not able to say, for it is not told, but in the end it happened as follows. Whenever Timoxenus wished to send a letter to Artabazus, or Artabazus to Timoxenus, they would wrap it around the notch of an arrow, and feathering it, shoot it to an agreed place. But Timoxenus' betrayal of Potidaea was discovered. For Artabazus, shooting at the agreed spot, missed it and struck a man of Potidaeae in the shoulder, and a crowd ran around the man who had been struck, as tends to happen in war, and they immediately took the arrow. And when they learned of the letter, they carried it to the generals. The allied forces of the other Pallenians were also present. When the generals had read the letter and learned who was responsible for the betrayal, they decided not to expose Timoxenus for his betrayal, for the sake of the city of Sion, so that the Cyanaeans should not be considered traitors for all time thereafter. He, then, was discovered in this way. But for Artabazus, when 3 months had passed in the siege, there occurred a great ebb of the sea, lasting a long time. The barbarians, seeing that a shoal had formed, passed over into Pallene. But when they had crossed 2 portions of the way, and 3 still remained, which they needed to cross to be safely inside Pallene, a great tidal surge of the sea came upon them, bigger than any that had ever occurred before, as the local people say, though it happens often enough. Those of them who did not know how to swim perished, and those who did know how the Potidaeans finished off by sailing out against them in boats. The Potidaeans say that the cause of the surge and the flood tide and the disaster to the Persians was this, that against the temple of Poseidon and the statue in the suburb these same Persians who were destroyed by the sea had committed sacrilege, and in saying this was the cause, they seemed to me to speak well. Those who survived Artabazus led away to Mardonius in Thessaly. Such was the fortune of those who had escorted the king. As for the fleet of Xerxes, the survivors, when it reached Asia in flight from Salamis and had ferried the king and the army across from the Chersonese to Abydos, wintered at Syme. When spring began to shine early, they gathered quickly at Samos. Some of the ships had wintered there too. Most of the Persians and Medes aboard were marines. As commanders there came to them Mardont son of Bagius and Artaint son of Artaches, and sharing command with these, at Artaint's own choosing, was his nephew Ithamedes. Since they had been struck so hard, they did not advance further westward, nor did anyone force them to. But sitting at Samos, they kept watch over Ionia, so that it should not revolt, having 300 ships including the Ionian ones. Nor did they expect the Greeks to come to Ionia at all, but thought it would be enough for them to guard their own, reckoning by the fact that the Greeks had not pursued them in their flight from Salamis, but had gladly gone off home. By sea then they were beaten in spirit, but on land they thought Mardonius would prevail by far. Being at Samos, they at once deliberated whether they could do their enemies any harm, and also listened out for which way Mardonius' affairs would turn. The coming of spring roused the Greeks, as did Mardonius being in Thessaly. The land army had not yet gathered, but the fleet arrived at Aegina, 110 ships in number. The general and admiral was Leutychides, son of Meners, son of Hegesilaus, son of Hippocratides, son of Leutychides, son of Anaxilaus, son of Archidamus, son of Anaxandrides, son of Theopompus, son of Nicander, son of Charilaus, son of Eunomus, son of Polydex, son of Prytanes, son of Euripon, son of Procles, son of Aristodemus, son of Aristomachus, son of Cleodius, son of Hyllus, Heracles' own line, and belonging to the other royal house. All these, except for the first seven named after Leutychides, were the other kings of Sparta. Of the Athenians, Xanthippus son of Ariphron was general. When all the ships had gathered at Aegina, messengers from the Ionians arrived at the camp of the Greeks, who had also gone to Sparta a little before this. They had arrived asking the Lacedaemonians to free Ionia, among them Herodotus son of Basilades, who with his fellow conspirators had plotted the death of Strates, tyrant of Chios, being seven in number. When their plot became known, one of those involved having betrayed the enterprise, the other six fled the island and made their way to Sparta, and now again to Aegina, asking the Greeks to sail down to Ionia. The Greeks brought them only as far as Delos, with great reluctance, for anything beyond that seemed altogether dangerous to the Greeks, who had no experience of those regions and imagined everything full of enemy forces. They believed Samos to be as far off as the pillars of Heracles. And it so happened that the barbarians, out of fear, dared not sail down further west than Samos, while the Greeks, though the Chians pressed them, would not go further east than Delos. So fear guarded the space between them. The Greeks then sailed to Delos, while Mardonius wintered around Thessaly. From there he set out and sent to the oracles a man of European stock named Mise, instructing him to go and consult every oracle he could test. What exactly he wished to learn from the oracles by giving these instructions I cannot say, for it is not recorded, but I myself suppose he sent concerning the present situation and nothing else. This Mise is reported to have gone to Lebedea, and by paying a local man, persuaded him to go down to Trophonius, and to have gone to Abe in Phocis to the oracle there. And indeed, when he first came to Thebes, he consulted Ismenian Apollo. For there, just as at Olympia, one may get an oracle from the sacrifices. And besides this, he persuaded some foreigner, not a Theban with money, to sleep in the shrine of Amphiaraus. No Theban is allowed to seek an oracle there for this reason. Amphiaraus, through oracles, bade them choose whichever of two things they wanted, to have him as a seer or as an ally, and to give up the other. They chose to have him as an ally. For this reason, no Theban is allowed to sleep there seeking an oracle. But at that time, the Thebans report an extraordinary marvel took place. This European Mise, making his rounds of every oracle in turn, came also to the precinct of Tone Apollo. This shrine is called the Tune and belongs to the Thebans. It lies above Lake Copais, very near the mountain by the city of Acrephia. When this man called Mise came to the shrine, three men chosen from the citizens by the community were following him, meant to record whatever oracle should be given, and suddenly the prophet delivered the oracle in a foreign tongue. The Thebans who were following were astonished to hear a foreign language instead of Greek, and did not know what to do with the situation before them. But Mise the European snatched from their hands the tablet they were carrying, on which he wrote what the prophet said, saying that the oracle had been given in the Carian tongue, and having written it down, he departed to Thessaly. Mardonius, having read whatever it was the oracle said, afterward sent as messenger to Athens Alexander son of Amyntas, a Macedonian, partly because the Persians were connected to him by marriage. For Buberes, a Persian, had married Gygia, sister of Alexander and daughter of Amyntas, from whom was born to him Amyntas of Asia, who bore the name of his mother's father, to whom the great city of Alabanda in Phrygia was given by the king to hold. And Mardonius sent him also, because he learned that Alexander was proxenos and benefactor of the Athenians. For he thought this was the best way to win the Athenians over, having heard that they were a numerous and valiant people, and knowing that it was chiefly the Athenians who had brought about the disasters that had befallen the Persians at sea. If these joined him, he expected easily to gain control of the sea, as indeed would have happened, and on land he thought himself far superior, and so he reckoned that his cause would prevail over that of the Greeks. Perhaps, too, the oracles told him this, advising him to make the Athenian his ally. Trusting these, he sent Alexander. Now the seventh ancestor of this Alexander was Perdiccas, who acquired the tyranny over the Macedonians in the following manner. Three brothers of the descendants of Temenus fled from Argos to Illyria, Gynes, Aeropus, and Perdiccas, and crossing over from Illyria into Upper Macedonia, they came to the city of Labia. There they served for wages under the king, one tending horses, another cattle, and the youngest of them, Perdiccas, the small livestock. Now the king's wife herself baked their food, for in ancient times the ruling houses of men, not only the common people, were poor in wealth. Whenever she baked, the bread of the boy Perdiccas, the hired servant, would come out double its own size. As this kept happening again and again, she told her husband, and he, on hearing it, was struck at once by the thought that it was a portent signifying something great. So he summoned the servants and told them to leave his land. They said it was only fair that they should receive their wages before departing. When the king heard talk of wages, for as it happened the sun was shining into the house through the smoke hole, he said, struck with madness, "I give you the wage you deserve, this," pointing to the sun. Now Gynes and Aeropus, the elder brothers, stood dumbfounded on hearing this. But the boy, who happened to be holding a knife, said, "We accept, O king, what you give." And with the knife he traced a circle on the floor of the house around the sun, and having traced it, he scooped into the fold of his garment three handfuls of sunlight, and then departed, he and his companions. So they went away. But one of the king's counselors told him what the boy had done, and how it was with understanding that the youngest of them had taken what was given. The king, hearing this and enraged, sent horsemen after them to kill them. But there is a river in that country, to which the descendants from Argos of these men sacrifice as their savior. This river, once the sons of Temenus had crossed it, rose so greatly that the horsemen were unable to cross. The brothers, coming into another part of Macedonia, settled near the so-called gardens of Midas son of Gordias, where roses grow of their own accord, each having 60 petals and surpassing all others in fragrance. In these very gardens, as the Macedonians say, Silenus was caught. Above the gardens lies a mountain called Bermion, impassable because of the cold. Setting out from there once they held this region, they went on to subdue the rest of Macedonia as well. From this Perdiccas, then, Alexander was descended as follows. Alexander was son of Amyntas, Amyntas of Alcetas, and Alcetas' father was Aeropus. His father was Philip, Philip's father was Argius, and his father was Perdiccas, who acquired the rule. This is what Alexander said. The Lacedaemonians learned that Alexander had reached Athens on a mission for the barbarian, seeking to win the Athenians over to an agreement, and recalling the oracles that said they, along with the other Dorians, were fated to be driven from the Peloponnese through the combined action of the Medes and the Athenians, were greatly afraid that the Athenians might come to terms with the Persian, and at once resolved to send envoys. And it so happened that both embassies arrived together, for the Athenians had deliberately delayed, knowing well that the Lacedaemonians would hear that a messenger had come from the barbarian to negotiate terms, and that on learning it, they would send envoys with all speed. They did this on purpose, to show the Lacedaemonians their own resolve. When Alexander had finished speaking, the envoys from Sparta took their turn and said, "The Lacedaemonians have sent us to ask you neither to do anything new in Greece nor to accept proposals from the barbarian. For this would be neither just nor honorable for any of the Greeks, but least of all for you, for many reasons. You are the ones who stirred up this war, though we wished nothing of the kind, and the struggle at first concerned your own territory, but now it extends to all of Greece. Besides, it is in no way to be endured that the Athenians should become the cause of slavery for the Greeks, you who have always, even long ago, shown yourselves to be liberators of many peoples. Still, we sympathize with you in your distress, since you have now been deprived of two harvests and your homes have been ruined for a long time now. In return for this, the Lacedaemonians and their allies promise to support your women and all those of your households useless for war, for as long as this war continues. Do not let Alexander the Macedonian win you over, smoothing out Mardonius' message as he does. He must act as he does, for being a tyrant himself he cooperates with a tyrant, but you must not act so, if indeed you are thinking rightly, knowing that among barbarians there is nothing trustworthy or true." So spoke the envoys, and the Athenians answered Alexander as follows. "We too know well that the power of the Mede is many times greater than ours, so there is no need to reproach us with that. But nonetheless, In our longing for freedom, we shall defend ourselves as best we can. Do not attempt to persuade us to come to terms with the barbarian, for we shall not be persuaded. And now report back to Mardonius that the Athenians say this. As long as the sun keeps to the same course by which it now goes, we shall never come to terms with Xerxes. Rather, trusting in the gods and heroes as our allies, we shall go out against him in our defense. The gods and heroes whom he showed no regard for when he burned their houses and their images. And in the future, do not come before the Athenians with speeches of that sort, nor, thinking you are doing them a service, urge them to do something unlawful. For we do not wish anything unpleasant to happen to you at the hands of the Athenians, seeing that you are our guest friend and friend. This was their reply to Alexander, but to the messengers from Sparta they said the following. That the Lacedaemonians should fear we might come to terms with the barbarian was very natural indeed. But it seems shameful that you, knowing well the spirit of the Athenians, should still have been afraid of this. That there is nowhere on earth so much gold, nor a land so surpassing in beauty and excellence, that we would accept it and be willing to enslave Greece by taking the Persian side. For there are many great reasons preventing us from doing this, even if we wish to. First and greatest, the images of the gods and their dwellings, burned and razed to the ground, which we are bound of necessity to avenge to the utmost, rather than come to terms with the one who did these things. And further, the fact that the Greek people are of one blood and one language, and have shared shrines of the gods and sacrifices, and alike customs, for the Athenians to become betrayers of these would not be right. Know this then, if you did not happen to know it before. As long as even one Athenian remains alive, we will never come to terms with Xerxes. We are grateful, however, for the concern you have shown for us, in that you foresaw our households being ruined and were willing to undertake to support our dependents. And for you the favor has been fulfilled in full. We, however, will hold out as best we can, without troubling you at all. But now, since things stand thus, send out an army as quickly as possible, for as we reckon, it will not be long before the barbarian arrives and invades our land, but as soon as he learns the news that we will do none of the things he asked of us. Before he arrives in Attica, then, it is time for us to go forth in aid to Boeotia. When the Athenians had given this answer, the envoys departed for Sparta.